Good morning. My name is Suzanne, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Coalition for Liberty and Justice telepress conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Megan Smith with Catholics for Free Choice, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Susanna. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining today's press conference call, Hobby Lobby is Just the Tip of the Iceberg, What Should We Expect?, featuring members of the Coalition for Liberty and Justice. My name is Megan Smith, and I am the Domestic Program Associate at Catholics for Choice. Today, we will hear from four leaders of Coalition for Liberty and Justice member organizations, Reverend Barry Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, Stacey Long, Director of Public Policy and Government Affairs for the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, Juliana Gonin, Director of Government Relations for the Center for Reproductive Rights, and Terry O'Neill, President of the National Organization for Women. The Coalition for Liberty and Justice, co-convened by Catholics for Choice and the National Council of Jewish Women, includes 59 national organizations as members. The members whom you will hear from today represent a diverse cross-section of our group, but there are many more. We have come together, despite our different issue areas, organizational goals, and ideologies, because we care about real religious freedom. We believe that religious liberty is too precious to warp into a weapon of discrimination. Instead, we are fighting for the rights of each person to have freedom of religion and freedom from religion.
Hello.
Within the next 4 weeks, the Supreme Court will release its decision in the Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Woods specialties cases regarding contraceptive coverage. In the debate surrounding these lawsuits, there are two sides. One, led by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops and its allies, has vocally attempted to cast contraceptive coverage as an affront to religious liberty, specifically the liberty of employers, and even more specifically, of employers like them. The other side, represented by those speaking today and by many more members of the Coalition for Liberty and Justice, firmly believe that contraceptive coverage upholds women's religious freedom and that the definition of religious freedom itself is at risk in the Hobby Lobby debate. Here is where federal contraceptive coverage regulations stand right now. As they have been from the beginning, women working for religious institutions like churches or synagogues that object to contraception are shut out from equal access. Not once did the administration consider that these women's religious liberty or health needs deserved attention. Women working for religiously affiliated organizations like universities or hospitals that object to contraceptive coverage are still in limbo. These workers will have to wait to learn the outcomes of cases like those of Notre Dame University, currently in lower courts, to learn their fates. Women working at for-profit and secular businesses are also waiting for the results of the Hobby Lobby and Conestoga cases at the Supreme Court, which could determine whether their bosses are able to trump their conscience-based decisions. Make no mistake, these cases are just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the debate surrounding religious freedom in this country. Recognizing this, 44 Coalition for Liberty and Justice member organizations, including the five organizations represented on this call today, signed a joint statement about Hobby Lobby and Conestoga, stating that we believe ensuring equal access to contraceptive coverage guarantees women's religious liberty rights, and that denying this coverage would be an affront to religious liberty. We know that today's threat to some workers' religious freedom could be tomorrow's civil rights disaster. The religious liberty rights of all of the people our organizations represent, women and men, LGBT and straight, patients and doctors, people of faith and atheists, are at risk. Today, the plaintiffs in the Hobby Lobby case, the Catholic bishops, and their allies are endangering the conscience rights of all people by attempting to redefine religious freedom to mean only the freedom to discriminate. We have seen this unconscionable attempt to distort the true meaning of religious freedom used by plaintiffs in the Hobby Lobby case. We have seen it used in Catholic schools where beloved teachers have been fired for getting married, being single and pregnant, or using in vitro fertilization. We have seen it in Mississippi, where a new law allows business owners to discriminate against customers. We have seen it in Congress, where, in a previous session, the Blunt Amendment would have allowed anyone involved in any aspect of healthcare to trample on patients' conscience rights. At Catholics for Choice, we know that the majority of the 70 million Catholics in the United States are not represented by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops of War on the religious liberty rights of workers, women, and LGBT people. Catholics stopped looking to the bishops for advice on birth control a long time ago. What remains mystifying for most of us is why policymakers, pundits, or judges would do so. The vast majority of Catholics in this country support contraceptive coverage, and we oppose carve-outs that allow any discrimination. 99% of sexually experienced Catholic women have used a form of birth control of which the bishops disapprove. When Catholics for Choice and six other Catholic organizations joined an amicus brief in the Hobby Lobby and Conestoga cases, our position therefore reflected the faithful beliefs of the majority of Catholics in this country. Catholics believe that women's consciences deserve respect and that individual people, not institutions, have religious liberty rights. At Catholics for Choice, we believe it is unjust to allow any employer, university administration, or hospital CEO to trample on the conscience rights of workers, students, or patients. It is insulting to mistake something so blatantly discriminatory, so clearly restrictive of some people's consciences, for freedom. Catholics believe that human dignity is not something earned by the size of one's paycheck or where that paycheck comes from, but simply by virtue of being human. As a young Catholic woman, I am lucky to work for a faith-based organization that respects people's conscience-based abilities to make personal decisions. I find it unconscionable, however, that any woman's religious liberty and healthcare rights should be left up to luck. While some Catholic-affiliated organizations claim that their freedom to serve is jeopardized by contraceptive coverage regulations, they are endangering the health and conscience rights of the people who serve them. Sandra, a Catholic science teacher at a Catholic middle school in the Midwest, is one of these people. She, like the majority of Catholic school teachers, is Catholic, and like the majority of Catholics, she uses contraception and supports access to birth control for herself and others. She called me, incensed, right after federal contraceptive coverage regulations passed, when she realized that she would still be left without any coverage for her birth control. Instead, she has to pay out of pocket for the expensive brand that is right for her, a major cost for a teacher who earns almost 50% less than her counterparts working in public schools. Sandra has been abandoned by loopholes, and she literally pays the price each month. If the Supreme Court rules the wrong way this month, there could be many more Sandras stuck in limbo, and they could be paying costs even more dear than dollars for more than contraception. We will now hear more about what these cases could mean for the future of religious freedom in this country. Reverend Barry Lynn from Americans United for Separation of Church and State will be our first speaker. Barry, go ahead.
Thank you very much. Last year, there were two very fine books written about the so-called Roberts Court, but neither one of them had a chapter called Religion and the Roberts Court. There simply wasn't enough to be said. But after this term, any new paperback edition of either of those books could contain a brand new chapter, and such a chapter might contain a discussion of a massive rewrite of the First Amendment itself. It all has to do with what the court does next month in the Hobby Lobby decision. Chief Justice Roberts himself began the inquiry at the oral argument by noting that this was essentially a case of statutory interpretation. What is the meaning of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act? Well, I was there at the conception of this legislation and for much of the three-year period of gestation before it became law in 1993. It was supported by so many groups, right, left, and center, precisely because it wasn't intended to have a very sweeping effect. Supporters in and out of Congress tended to use the same examples, like Muslim firefighters should be able to wear beards or sacramental wine should be permitted in dry counties, because almost anything else was too controversial. If anyone in those 3 years had suggested that a national chain of for-profit craft stores employing over 10,000 people could use this statute to avoid coverage of contraceptives in an insurance plan, it would have been a shot heard round the world, loud enough to drown out any further kumbaya moments by this coalition. The statute says that government shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion unless such a burden serves a compelling government interest and is the least restrictive means of furthering that interest. All of these phrases are now the source of constitutional controversy at the high court, starting with persons. Corporations have been considered persons for some reasons since the 1900s, but this does not mean that all corporations necessarily have all constitutional rights. Even after the Citizens United case, which established a broad range of free speech rights for most corporations, many of us recognize that corporations often had speech as a central practice. It is called advertising, and it costs at least $1.5 million per minute if done on the Super Bowl. But for-profit companies like Hobby Lobby do not in any real sense engage in the exercise of religion as a part of their functioning. The do-it-yourself wind chimes, the garden gnome cross-stitch kits that they sell are not religious icons. The fact that the Green family that owns most of Hobby Lobby's stock are conservative evangelical Protestants, or that they play Christmas music in their stores in December, does not convert that company into a church. The corporate entity remains focused on making money, as it has every right to do. Its owners receive the tax benefits and freedom from liability and lawsuits, just like any owners of any other American company receive that choose to organize as a corporation. Lots of benefits. Even if Hobby Lobby and its judicial partner Conestoga Wood are deemed persons under this act, there is absolutely no credible claim of a substantial burden on any exercise of their corporate conscience. These companies need only provide an insurance policy through yet a different company that has an entirely separate legal status from Hobby Lobby itself that covers contraceptive services, not abortion services, by the way, that an employee may use in furtherance of her own independent medical and moral judgment. This attenuated connection between a woman's decision, say, to use an IUD and a wood cabinet manufacturer's personal religious beliefs frankly stretches the definition of being any burden at all. But speaking of burdens, the failure to provide coverage for women employees intrudes significantly on their own conscientious and often religiously based beliefs that responsible family planning and avoidance of unwanted pregnancies is a moral good. Whether one loves or hates the Affordable Care Act, it does provide a framework for a comprehensive health care system with a very strong preventative care component, including contraceptive services. A raft of religiously based exceptions would undercut the character of this system. In the Supreme Court case of United States versus Lee in 1982, an Amish company wished to be exempt from taking out Social Security taxes for its employees. But the court, the Supreme Court, rejected this exemption in order to preserve the integrity of the overall functioning of the Social Security system, notwithstanding that the Amish were hardly a large or growing faith on America's religious landscape. It also expressed concern that individual employees might find themselves a part of a kind of orphaned class, unable to obtain benefits available to other workers. And the benefit at issue in the Hobby Lobby case is real, and it is substantial. Some of the very drugs vetoed in the company coverage are used for non-contraceptive purposes, dealing with serious medical conditions. Moreover, implantation of an IUD forbidden under the Hobby Lobby's position is at least 8 times more effective than some of the alternatives, and this is the data that cannot be trivialized. Allowing exemptions from laws of general applicability based on either institutional or personal religious claims by corporate bosses opens a Pandora's box with some very ugly creatures flying out. In healthcare alone, surely Scientology-believing employers could insist on non-coverage of its nemesis, psychiatry, and Jehovah's Witness-owned corporations could demand exclusion from surgical coverage under the theory that so many of such procedures require the use of whole blood products forbidden by their faith. And this is where the real anarchy begins. When the topic in the 1990 case of Employment Division versus Smith was whether prohibiting the use of peyote for religious purposes by Native Americans was unconstitutional, it was Justice Scalia himself who voiced the opinion that it was not a violation of their constitutional rights, noting that if religious beliefs relieved people of an obligation to comply with neutral laws, quoting Justice Scalia, any society adopting such a system would be courting anarchy. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, enacted after the Smith case, would reach the precisely same result if Hobby Lobby gets its way. Although, parenthetically, I don't expect that Justice Scalia will echo his own words in June. If Hobby Lobby prevails, I see no reason why a religious group opposed to equal pay requirements could not assert that men must be paid more than women because of male dominance in their scriptural social order, as Christ is head of the church, so the husband is head of the family. And even if one takes race discrimination off the table, the legislative initiative in Mississippi, for example, appears designed to permit even those offering public accommodations to exclude services to persons whom store owners find religiously objectionable. You can hear them say, "We don't believe that marriage equality is biblical, so you LGBT travelers, cannot stay in our hotel or eat in our restaurant." Far from being speculative, there are already cases we'll hear about later involving refusal of a Colorado baker to make a post-wedding cake for a gay couple and a New Mexico photography service company to film a same-sex commitment ceremony. Hobby Lobby could prove to be the biggest breach in the wall of separation in modern history. James Madison once said that religion should be left alone, quoting him though, unless in every case where it does not trespass on private rights or the public peace. I think Mr. Madison would be on this call with us, not saying amen to Senator Orrin Hatch's bizarre tantrum yesterday, in which he said he would demand a constitutional amendment if Hobby Lobby does not prevail at the United States Supreme Court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barry. We'll next hear from Stacey Long with the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force.
Yes, thank you. I'm Director of Public Policy and Government Affairs at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and our organization was founded over 40 years ago as the first national LGBT advocacy group. And our mission is to build the grassroots power of the LGBT community as part of a broader social justice movement. And so we recognize that Hobby Lobby could potentially pave the way for businesses and individuals to use religion as a basis for ignoring federal laws and as a license to discriminate against others. Our unwavering position is that reproductive justice and freedom and lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender equality are, at their very core, inextricably intertwined. We have a common cause dating back to Roe v. Wade and the carve-outs we've seen over the years in cases along the lines of Griswold, Casey, and Carhartt, that the central issue is about privacy. And this is a battle only recently won by the LGBT community in Lawrence v. Texas. 17 years after Bowers v. Hardwick, the Supreme Court directly overruled its decision in Lawrence and held that anti-sodomy laws are unconstitutional. Last summer marked the 10-year anniversary of the Lawrence decision. Reproductive justice is essential to the full recognition of LGBT people's rights to raise their children and build their families, whether through marriage equality, non-discrimination laws, or health care reform. And our organization is deeply committed to the issues and concerns of transgender and gender nonconforming people. Notably, more than 4 out of 5 transgender and gender nonconforming people are refused appropriate medical and reproductive health care, with higher numbers, even higher numbers, among people of color. And third, at the core of both reproductive justice and LGBT equality is the belief that society must remove barriers that interfere with people's ability to lead healthy sexual and reproductive lives, be it through voluntary or forced sexual contact with men. Lesbian, bisexual, transgender men, and queer women are at risk for pregnancy and need the protections that reproductive justice provides. We know that there is a well-funded and well-organized opposition to women's access to comprehensive and affordable reproductive health care, and they represent the very same forces that want to control what we, as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, do with our bodies and our access to health care. They want to turn back the clock, they want to block progress, and use tired arguments to justify any erosion of rights and discrimination. Marriage, for us, marriage recognition is just the tip of the iceberg. Last summer, the Windsor and Perry court decisions were incredible victories for our community. We want to win marriage rights for our community in every state, and we're pleased that there's been considerable momentum through the courts and public ballot initiatives in many states. But marriage recognition is just the tip of the iceberg for the LGBT community. We're using the focus on marriage to build momentum that will be needed to finish the job in other areas, such as employment, housing, homelessness, and violence. We're still working to be counted on national surveys and to address high rates of violence against members of our community, particularly youth and transgender women. And according to one survey, 19% of LGBT respondents had been homeless at some point in their lives, and 11% had been evicted based on their gender identity or expression. Employment protections are a priority focus for my organization. Upwards of 43% of LGB people have experienced forms of discrimination and harassment on the job, and 90% of transgender people have experienced such. Yet LGBT workers still don't have a federal law that explicitly protects us against employment discrimination. Well over half the states in this country still don't protect LGBT people from employment and discrimination in employment. And overwhelming majorities of the public, in fact, 9 out of 10 voters, believe that we already have such a law. So while the number of states with marriage equality has doubled in the last year, and states like Maryland have moved the country forward by adding explicit non-discrimination protections on the basis of gender identity, we still have a ways to go with respect to protections. The pace of change has been sparked by a backlash of discriminatory legislation in states like Arizona, Tennessee, Kansas, Idaho, and Missouri. In fact, there were over 14 jurisdictions where such measures were introduced. Arizona's SB 1062, which was defeated because we stood up collectively in coalition to oppose that discriminatory measure, thankfully was vetoed by Governor Brewer. However, that was not the case in Mississippi, where the governor signed a religious refusal measure that will take effect this summer. The majority of the states that are introducing these bills are using free exercise of religion as the title of these bills, and they're using reasoning that they're referring to in the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The bills are problematic because they're broad, and any individual, association, partnership, corporation, church, or religious assembly or institution can cite their religion as a tool to refuse service to someone who identifies as LGBT or exhibits some trait that they find objectionable. For instance, an owner could refer to someone who's pregnant outside of wedlock, or someone who is wearing a tattoo, or someone who is gender nonconforming, and basically jeopardize the well-being of those individuals either by declining them services or refusing to provide public services, or by refusing to provide them with fee services. For example, a baker declining to bake a cake for someone at a same-sex wedding, or an employer choosing to fire someone because they are LGB or T. We believe that these bills negatively affect the economy, that they are bad for business, and that they are bad for families. And if we lose under Hobby Lobby, we believe that the floodgates will open, and that businesses would be allowed to discriminate on the basis of their personal religious belief in a variety of areas. And these can include health insurance issues and access like birth control, emergency contraception, family planning, indeed vaccines, surgeries, blood transfusions, mental health care, HIV/AIDS treatment, coverage of spouses and children, and a whole host of other things. And we expect that if we lose, there will be many more discriminatory laws like the one in Mississippi that will be put forward. And when the decision happened in Windsor and Perry, decisions that happened last summer, immediately following that, the court issued the decision in Shelby, which cut the Voting Rights Act. And we at the task force felt the effects of that decision deeply and have been part of the collective effort to address the court's ruling with a bipartisan legislative fix. By that very same token, if we lose on Hobby Lobby, we would work very hard in coalition with others to pursue whatever opportunities may exist so that we can continue to fight to preserve protections and advance rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Stacey. We'll now hear from Juliana Gonin with the Center for Reproductive Rights.
Thank you very much, Megan. I am Juliana Gonin, Director of Government Relations at the Center for Reproductive Rights, which is a global human rights organization that uses the law to advance reproductive freedom as a fundamental human right that all governments are legally obligated to protect, respect, and fulfill. We work to expand access to contraception both in the United States and abroad. We advocated for inclusion of women's preventive services, including contraception, in the Affordable Care Act. We've pushed for robust implementation of that benefit by opposing exemptions for objecting employers. And we have filed amicus briefs in the various legal challenges to the contraception benefit, including Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood. We're part of the Coalition for Liberty and Justice because we strongly believe that public policies should respect both religious liberty and the right of individuals to make their own personal reproductive health decisions for themselves. And we oppose the use of religious beliefs to discriminate or to undermine basic human rights. In the Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood cases, bosses at for-profit companies are trying to impose their own religious beliefs on their employees and deny them coverage for essential preventive care. It's actually quite extraordinary that these employers believe that they would have the right to make these decisions for their employees. Hobby Lobby and Conestoga are not being asked to directly provide contraception to their workers. Instead, they offer their employees health insurance that covers a wide array of medical services, including birth control. Any decision to actually use birth control rests with the employees, not with the insurance providers or the companies. We have to remember that health insurance is a form of compensation, just like wages or retirement benefits. We would all find it absurd if a company owner were to suggest that he could tell a female employee that she could not spend her wages on birth control. And yet that's exactly what the plaintiffs in these cases are asking for. They want to tell female employees that they may not use their health insurance for basic preventive and reproductive health care services. Here's the bottom line. Contraception is essential preventive health care for women. When birth control is not affordable, women don't use it, or they use it inconsistently, or they can't afford the method that's best for them. Allowing bosses to withhold essential preventive health care services on religious grounds is not only bad for individual women, it is also bad for public and community health. And where would it end? Today it's contraception, but as Barry Lynn and Stacey Long noted, next it could be vaccines, prenatal care for unmarried women, in vitro fertilization, blood transfusions, HIV treatment, et cetera. No one is forcing the owners of these companies to violate their beliefs and use contraception. Rather, the company owners are trying to force their beliefs on their employees by making it harder for those employees to access affordable contraception and make very personal decisions about their health and their families. Remember, employees have religious liberty too. The U.S. Supreme Court should use this opportunity to strongly reinforce the bedrock principles of individual liberty on which this nation was founded, and to establish clear limits on the assertion of corporate rights in defiance of federal law and individual rights. We remain hopeful that the court will reject the claims of these corporate plaintiffs. True religious liberty means allowing people to practice their own religion and also protecting people from having the religious beliefs of others imposed upon them. A ruling upholding the contraception benefit will allow everyone, the company owners and their employees, to follow their own consciences about their health care. All around the globe, women's access to affordable contraception has been consistently recognized as key to furthering a woman's liberty, dignity, equality, and economic empowerment. As we at the center argued in our amicus brief filed at the Supreme Court in these cases, in other countries, when a right to conscientious objection is recognized, it is viewed as belonging to individuals, not to corporations. And it is only applicable to individuals such as healthcare providers who would be directly involved in providing the service to which there is an objection. To give just a couple of examples, in Norway, Spain, Italy, and the United Kingdom, only healthcare providers directly involved in a medical procedure may claim the right to conscientiously object to that procedure. In Colombia, the Constitutional Court in that nation found that the right to object to reproductive health services, quote, an individual decision and not institutional or collective, unquote. The individual right to conscientious objection has not been recognized in any other constitutional democracy to encompass claims like those asserted in these cases. And perhaps most importantly, a woman's right to access healthcare services is held as paramount, such that even if a healthcare provider objects to a service, he or she must ensure that the woman can still get the care or services she seeks. In other words, the woman seeking care must not be any worse off as a result of the assertion of the healthcare provider's conscientious objection rights. Allowing these corporations to deny contraceptive coverage to their employees would deprive thousands of women of a critical preventive healthcare benefit. If the Supreme Court rules in favor of Hobby Lobby, the United States will be an outlier among developed nations. Preventing unintended pregnancy is a key public health objective. In fact, contraception is considered one of the 10 greatest public health achievements of the 20th century. But the out-of-pocket costs of contraception can be prohibitive for many women, especially for the more effective long-acting methods like IUDs or implants. Contraception assures that women can plan and appropriately space their pregnancies, leading to better health for women and for the children they might have. These cases are about the employees of these companies, about allowing them to make the healthcare decisions that are right for them, free from meddling by their bosses. The thousands of employees of Hobby Lobby are undoubtedly from a wide range of religious faiths and of no faith. By taking a job with this corporation, they did not agree to conform their personal healthcare behaviors to the religious beliefs of the Green family. The Women's Preventive Services benefit in the Affordable Care Act was a huge step forward for women and for public health. Women's essential health care needs should not be subverted to the personal religious beliefs of their bosses. The Supreme Court should maintain the proper balance between religious liberty and the right of individuals to make their own personal reproductive health care decisions by upholding the contraception benefit. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Juliana. Finally, we'll hear from Terry O'Neill from the National Organization for Women.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks all for being here, and thank you especially to Catholics for Choice and the Coalition on Liberty and Justice for bringing us all together. This is a really important, hugely important moment, I think, in U.S. history. My organization has called attempts to restrict birth control nothing other than gender bigotry. And what we're seeing in the Hobby Lobby case is the Supreme Court very possibly buying into the idea that it's okay to use religion as an excuse for a gender bigotry. I use that word very deliberately. The history is full of other examples in which religion has been abused to justify apartheid in South Africa. The supporters of apartheid relied on their religion to explain why they thought that was a good idea. The Southern Baptists in the United States used their religion to justify not only slavery but also segregation. It was not until 1995 that the Southern Baptists apologized for the abuse of their religion in that fashion. Just recently in California, when Proposition 8 was being was put before the voters, the primary funders of those trying to stop marriage equality in California were religious organizations, and the primary arguments made against marriage equality in California were religion-based arguments. So, and all of those arguments, the marriage equality, apartheid, segregation, slavery. All of those institutions, all of the reliance on religion to justify that kind of discrimination has been thoroughly, thoroughly discredited throughout really throughout the world. And so the idea that the Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice Roberts, would actually contemplate going back to the use of religion to justify a form of bigotry is really alarming. And I want to take just a moment and explain why we do very deliberately use the term gender bigotry to describe efforts to block women's access to contraception. It's very simple. Unintended pregnancy is highly correlated with high rates of infant mortality and maternal mortality, and unintended pregnancy is even highly correlated with higher incidence of domestic violence homicide. You don't get to call yourself pro-life if you try to stop women from accessing birth control. Women who experience unintended pregnancy have experienced it because they don't have access to birth control that they can utilize consistently and correctly. So birth control, I think there can be no question that birth control is basic health care for women. It has, where it's available to women, it has dramatically reduced the incidence of unintended pregnancy and the attendant incidence of infant mortality, maternal mortality, and domestic violence homicide. So we think that that it's extremely important that the Supreme Court not take this opportunity to take yet one more step down the road of undermining its own legitimacy by promoting an ideological and political agenda at the expense of women and women's access to basic health care. So with that, that's really our position. I'm going to stop a little bit early and so we can get on to the questions and answers.
Great. Thank you, Carrie. We will now open up the call for questions from members of the press, and I will ask that because Terry O'Neill does have a previous engagement directly following this call, if you've a specific question for Terry, please do place yourself immediately in queue.
Thank you. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Jennifer Harkerberg. Your line is open.
And for taking my question, I'm wondering if you guys can talk a little bit about what a ruling for Hobby Lobby would mean for the rest of the health law, and what specifically would you expect if the court were to rule for Hobby Lobby, what the ruling would look like. I mean, would you expect HHS to have some kind of directive to rewrite the regulation, or would it say that a company can choose what they have a religious objection to? Thanks.
Speakers, go ahead.
This is Barry Lynn. I think depending on the way in which this decision is written, there could be all kinds of efforts and discussions about altering the statute. I don't think that this is a politically ripe time to do that.
Jamie,
I think
have
one,
you got Bridge?
Go ahead, Barry.
I do think that the one thing that would be clear is that if there's a medical, so-called medical exception based on a win by Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood, that it would be very difficult for the Supreme Court with a straight face not to permit every other kind of, at a minimum, medically based exemptions that follow someone else's religious beliefs or traditions, no matter how idiosyncratic they might be. And as I pointed out in my statement, I think it would go way well beyond that, allowing the trumping of all kinds of federal legislation by religious claims by groups or individuals. That would be a real travesty.
Are there any more responses? Operator, if we can take the next question, please.
Certainly. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star, the number one on your telephone keypad. There are no further questions at this time. I'll turn the call back over to the presenters.
Thank you, Susanna. So once again, I'd like to thank our speakers, Barry Lynn, Stacey Long, Juliana Gonin, and Terry O'Neill for their remarks. And thank you all for joining us on this really important conversation. As reflected by the speakers on today's call who represent separation of church and state, LGBT, women's rights, reproductive rights, and faith-based organizations, the Coalition for Liberty and Justice is a broad-based alliance. We work together, however, to ensure that public policy protects the religious liberty of individuals of all faiths and no faith, and to oppose public policies that impose one religious viewpoint on all. We are united in our strong conviction that real religious freedom is precious. We believe that current efforts to redefine religious freedom as a weapon for discrimination are wolves in sheep's clothing, and we will continue to stand up strongly against them. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.